In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today sees the release of the new Netflix series Vikings Valhalla, the successor to the hugely popular show Vikings. Set 100 years after the original series, it follows three figures from the sagas: Leif Erikson, Freydis Eriksdottir, and Harald Sigurdsson, whose journeys begin in the wake of the St. Brice's Day massacre of 1002. Kev Lotchen spoke to the showrunner of Vikings Valhalla, Jeb Stuart. They spoke about the real history behind the show, the challenges of balancing fact and fiction, and how the series could take us all the way up to 1066.
Jeb, thank you so much for joining me to talk about your new Netflix series, Vikings Valhalla, which is a spin-off and successor to Michael Hirst's hugely successful series, Vikings. It's set around 100 years after season 6 of Vikings finishes and introduces us to a new generation of Viking warriors and rulers. My first question is really a grounding one, in that the series is subtitled Valhalla, Valhalla being the believed afterlife of Norse warriors. I wonder, why did you choose that particular word to encapsulate this entire series?
When I found the place to come in on the series, we knew some of the characters that we really wanted to go after. You know, Harald Sigurdsson, Leif Erikson, Freydis Eriksdottir, Eric the Red, that group. And of course, they all encompass not necessarily the same period, but a generally a reasonable amount of time that, you know, we could put them together. We're in a period in Scandinavian history where Christianity has really started to, as we say sometimes in the series, it's like a wave that's come across. And most of Western Europe at this time, in the 11th century, had already experienced conversion to Christianity by centuries. Scandinavia was sort of that last holdout. It's that place where the old pagan ways are starting to just gradually start to let go. And Whereas Michael's series really dealt with the Lindisfarne raid, the mythical parts of Ragnar Lothbrok and all of the beginnings of the Viking era. You know, my series really deals with sort of the latter half of the Viking era. And so if you think about that, you know, to your point of Valhalla being sort of the afterlife of all great Viking warriors, you know, one of the two places that you could end up and a great place to end up, where you die in battle and the Valkyries take you and you sit at Odin's table with all your friends and you drink until Ragnarok comes around. It just felt like there was a sense of almost nostalgia. And I know nostalgia is not something that pops to mind in a Viking show, but it really is. And as we develop these characters and they have to give up some of that, you know, give up some of the old ways, as we see them having to deal with Christianity, what does that mean? How does that work? And all those kind of things. Valhalla becomes a more and more important word as the series goes along.
It's really interesting to hear you speak of how the earlier show dealt with beginnings and where Valhalla is going now, because, well, I've watched all 8 episodes and I've really enjoyed them, but it felt very much this is kind of setting up a beginning of an end. And I'd like to talk about a beginning and an end as we go along. But I'll start at the beginning, and that's where your story kicks off, which is with the St. Brice's Day Massacre. And that's kind of the linchpin event that really gets the plot going. I wonder, could you tell us what that event is and why you chose to start there?
Well, you know, the St. Brice's Day Massacre, which happened in 1002, it was an interesting piece for me because it allowed me to kind of peg the Vikings in an almost an underdog fashion to start with, which I kind of like always when you're telling a story and we're getting away from sort of the historical parts. But some of the things that I like in history is coming into a period. I do this all the time, and I'm sure, you know, your listeners do too, where you say, I know everything there is to know about X, Y, and Z. And then suddenly you get in and you read a new, you know, piece of archaeological research or a new paper or some new piece of history that suddenly turns the story around, maybe not 180 degrees, but maybe it turns it about 90 degrees. And suddenly you're looking at it from a different angle. And what St. Brice's Day Massacre for me, because we were, you know, I think internationally, we were when this whole series was just sort of a twinkle in my eye, internationally, we're dealing with these great big ideological splits, the right and the left, and, you know, all of those type of things. It was fascinating to me that in the 11th century, King Athelred was dealing with a very similar problem for over 100, almost 150, maybe even 200 years, if you want to go way back. He was dealing with Viking immigrants. And they were coming over and settling in these areas of the Danelaw, which, if you look at a 10th century map of England, you know, we're starting to really encroach upon London in the south, and they were starting to marry into Saxon society. And if you look at it, it was already to the point where Athelred's own personal bodyguard were all Viking descendants. And so I thought this was a very fascinating thing. And as he said very clearly in his speech a year later, you know, it was a just extermination. He termed it an extermination. He wanted it to be a genocide, but he would not have undertaken that, Kevin, in my opinion, had he not thought that back up in Norway, the Vikings who were at each other's throats, the Christians and the pagans, would not have come together. And historically, we've seen this time and time and time again that, you know, sometimes great forces, you know, despots and dictators use certain opportunities where they take calculated risks that the person they're going to fight will not get their act together. And in this case, of course, King Canute was able to unite the Vikings, both pagan and Christian, and they did come to England, and the rest was history, so to speak.
You mentioned there about unrest in Scandinavia at the time, and it's a really interesting section of the story that Valhalla portrays. Is a Viking society that's riven internally with its religious tension between those who adopted Christianity and those who still worship the Norse gods. And I just wondered how you approach that when we have this stereotypical image of all Vikings being pagans.
Well, there are two parts to that. I mean, first of all, the Christian part of it, you know, we have to remember that even in the 11th century, Christianity, as we think of it today, was probably not, you know, the religion that we would you would see in Sweden or parts of Norway or Denmark at that time. You know, it was a politically expedient tool. You know, it was the type of thing that if you got a lot of perks if you converted over, especially if you were in the ruling class. And yet, you know, there's plenty of instances where, you know, the rulers would sort of nod to Rome, but then they would also celebrate the gods that, you know, they had grown up on at the same time. So it was a long conversion period, much longer than it was in France at the time, or obviously other parts of Europe. I think this was, and I may not be answering your question, but I think that it's, for me, again, what does a Christian Viking look like? How different is that than a pagan Viking? And of course, I don't think you have to look at too far in history, the Crusades being, you know, one of the things that came on the doorstep of this particular series, to see that, you know, just being a Christian warrior doesn't really stop you from slaughter or anything else. So I think that the Vikings felt quite comfortable. The Christian Vikings didn't have any problem with their identity as Vikings.
Now, you're telling these kind of wider stories through the eyes of three lead characters. We mentioned a couple of them earlier, but just to recap, they are the Nordic prince, Harald Sigurdsson, who perhaps we might know a little better as Harald Hardrada, and there are two Greenlanders, the brother and sister, Leif and Freydis Eriksson. Now, we should say that these are real historical figures, and they do appear in the sagas, but could you perhaps ground us here and tell us a little bit about what the sagas are and what they tell us about these three people?
Most of what we know or think we know about Leif Erikson and his sister Freydis Erik's daughter, who were, you know, obviously children of Erik the Red. We know from the sagas of the Greenlanders and just keep in mind that there was no written language. You know, there was no written Old Norse at that particular time. So a lot of these are just stories that have been told and retold. The sagas, of course, were told in, I believe, the 12th century. The point is, by the time we get to the 12th century, we're definitely well into Christianity. So you're in a situation where, you know, telling the story of, say, Freydis Eriksdotter, who was a fierce, really fierce female character, brutal in fact, you know, showing her in sort of an uncultured way is also, it does two things. One, it builds up that mythic, you know, piece about her, but it also points back and say, look, we're in better places from a Christian standpoint now than we were back then. I read them and I still look at certain sections of the sagas as sort of a guidepost, but they were human characters. And they're going through the same thing that our human character, you know, we do in the 21st century. So I'm trying to find relevant pieces, not just go on what the sagas tell us.
It's interesting to hear how you talk about the sagas there. Vikings Valhalla, it struck me almost by kind of the necessity of the paucity of some of these historical sources. You have these fictional character storylines that are kind of threaded around real events on a much broader scale. How do you balance those facts with telling a great story?
You know, I was doing a World War II story once, it was based on a true story, you know, and about a true character. And the book was very well researched. And but I typically, whenever I take over a story, I would read the underlying material, and then I go out on my own and start to research it. And one of the things that I found was that a lot of the underlying material for that World War II story based upon this person's real life was told to the author in 2010. But I went back and read the same character's telling of the story in 1990, and it was a little different. And I went back to 1972 and he gave an interview and it was completely different. In 1961, it was totally different. In 1954. So it shows you how a true story bends sometimes with age of the character that's telling the story. It becomes like the telephone game. So what we try to do is be extremely accurate to things that we have a great handle on. For example, costumes, boats, you know, the artifacts of the surroundings of our story. Kattegat, our fictional town, only has buildings which would have, and we have evidence that would have existed in the 11th century in that particular fictional part of Norway that we're working in. In other words, we're not going to show two or three story buildings that are built of stone that you would have found, you know, other places. So we're very accurate in those areas where we take liberty, or where I take liberty, being the, I hate to make that the royal we, but where I take liberty when I'm telling the story in one way or the other is I like to play in the gray area. Okay, we know that a character got to London at X. We know that, you know, something happened that, you know, that's been written about multiple times. What we don't know sometimes is what his motivation or his thinking was or who came into contact. We just don't have that piece. That's that gray area I'm talking about. Well, I can give you a story in any gray area. So, but I like having it buttressed by the facts around that allow it to be something, you know, something believable that I, you know, that I feel could very, you know, specifically happen. And then, of course, whenever I do have an idea like that, Kevin, I do run it by our researchers because, you know, the researchers a lot of times because will say, well, maybe, you know, a maybe is not really good enough. But, you know, what I'm not looking for is that's exactly what happened. It's like no one knows, but it needs to have certain aspects of it that just are unassailable. In other words, I'm not going to have a spaceship come down in Norway, and I mean I'm not going to have a spaceship come down anywhere, or a dragon or anything like that. But you know what I'm saying? We know where our areas are. That said, the Vikings, Michael Hirst show, you know, put Rollo and Ragnar as brothers, and anyone who knows history knows that didn't happen. A and B, if it had happened, it would have meant that Rollo would have been born 200 years early. So, you know, the audience didn't have much difficulty accepting that and moving forward, because so much of the rest of the show is so accurate. So, I took precedent from Michael, and you know, I've got Leif and Harold Sigurdsson together, but I don't think it, you know, stops the story.
We should also talk about the relationship between your show and Michael Hirst's as well. I felt somewhat inevitable because fans of historical Viking drama fiction are likely to have watched both shows, that you're almost going to be looking at this one through the lens of the other. And, you know, having watched it, it feels to me that Valhalla is somewhat a bit pacier, a bit less mythic. Do you feel there's a thread running between the two?
We shared Viking DNA. There's no question. I mean, you know, it's those kind of questions ought to be very difficult to answer, but they're really not. Okay. I mean, anybody who has seen Elizabeth and seen Die Hard know that Jeb Stuart and Michael Hirst are two different types of writers. And I think Michael is a spectacular writer, and I'm a huge fan of the six seasons of the Vikings. But the one thing that I would never be able to do is write a Vikings episode. And I had no desire to write season 7 of the Vikings. You mentioned that Michael's characters possess a lot more of the mythic aspect of it. Well, in that particular time in the Viking history, they are more mythic. You know, we know less about them. You know, a character like Ragnar Lothbrok, you know, comes in and out of history as opposed to being a well-defined character. Whereas when we get to the 11th century, Harold Sigurdsson took a whole group of skalds, of poets with him wherever he went. So they wrote, they were his press agents. They wrote great glowing things about everywhere he went. And of course, you have to look through that with a lens as well. Emma of Normandy, you know, she wrote her own biography, which is pretty glowing as well. So, you know, we have a lot more written down. We can look at the Bayeux Tapestry and see Emma. We can see things that, you know, that were not present in the original Viking. So, yeah, if my characters seem a little bit more or a little less mythic, it's because we're moving into a different point in history where people are starting to take note and write things down, and we're getting a little bit more under the microscope.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
You know, we would love to tell the full Leif Erikson story. And for me, it's not just a matter of, hey, let's send him to the New World. It's like, how did he have the wherewithal to fight those great Atlantic currents that he could find his way there?
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The founder of Panasonic once said,
"We can lead more meaningful and constructive lives
through the pursuit of activities that will ensure
a better today than yesterday,
a better tomorrow than today."
Panasonic is committed to creating a greener,
more equitable future for everyone.
Explore Panasonic Green Impact
at na.panasonic.com/green impact.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta. Because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members. Because at Delta, we know.
Refill?
Everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.
And I'd like to circle back as well to Leif's sister, Freydis. She's one of the three main characters, but arguably perhaps the one we know the least about. She's listed in two sagas. In one, she's quite the hero. And the other, she's quite the villain. Who are we getting here in your story?
I think you're getting an amalgam of this. I tried to take from these characters, I'm not trying to tell a documentary of Freydis Eriksdotter. And if I did, it would be through a lens that is, you know, 8 centuries away. So I wouldn't feel accurate doing that. But I do think that the sagas point out certain aspects of her character, and also from a dramatic, historical dramatic standpoint, there are other features that I have to deal with. For example, what does she share with her brother Leif? What does she share with her mother? What did she pull from her mother we're going to see her mother. We're going to see other characters that would have had influences on her. And that's part of the fun of watching something dramatic. For you to suddenly say, oh, I see where that came from, that violent streak, or I see where that tenderness comes from and things like that. And, you know, fortunately, we're really blessed with a fabulous actress, you know, in Frida Gustafsson, who really can embody so many parts of a very complex character.
And it did strike me as well, I think I've got this right, that when I was watching the TV series, all of the warrior women in the show are pagan Vikings. There aren't any who are also Christian. I think I've got that right. But is that an intentional decision and commentary?
I think we can qualify that by saying that there are maybe the main characters in season one. Okay. But there are a lot of Viking women who fight in season one who probably were Christian. Okay. They would be in the forces and the army and the invasion force back in Kattegat and other places like that. So it's a time period of a mix. And a lot of times, you may have been pagan and yet you wore a crucifix around your neck because it was much more, you know, it was safer. It was safer. These mass conversions or forced conversions were, especially with Olaf Haraldsson, Olaf the Stout, those are pretty brutal. I mean, you know, they're Vikings took that Christian conversion pretty seriously. So, you raised your hand when you were told and you wore the crucifix. So it became more and more the pagan parts will be forced underground.
To broaden the conversation a little, it strikes me that the Vikings as a whole remain a wellspring of fascination for us right now, especially in pop culture. And we've got Vikings Valhalla, your own show. We're about to get a new season of The Last Kingdom. There's a film coming out this spring called The Northmen. What is it in your mind about the Vikings in general that's delivered this kind of enduring appeal?
The jaded answer is that we love Viking shows just like we love dinosaur shows. You know, it'll always be an enduring genre of that type of thing. But personally, what I was drawn to is it was an incredible culture at the turn of the millennium where, you know, there was an egalitarian society where your glory, your success, your the way you approach life could be celebrated, and you could actually rise out of, you know, a situation that's similar to how Ragnar Lothbrok and Michael portrayed that. It's a society where women could own property, they could rule countries, they could divorce their husbands. You know, when you get to 1066 and William the Conqueror comes in, that kind of like became the Dark Ages for women's rights for the next 1,000 years. So it becomes, again, there's a sense of sort of this, going back to your very first question about Valhalla, there's this almost nostalgia about this particular period in terms of the egalitarian or the chance for ambitious behavior that could be celebrated in an equal society. It also, from, you know, you're talking to an old action writer here, it also gives you the plans for lots of terrific action, which, you know, is not knights on horseback. It's a much darker, it's a much more medieval, it's, you know, an interesting time. What I think you fans, I'm one of them. One of the things that I loved about Michael's show was that he blew life into a culture that we really thought we knew only as a barbaric society. And we saw that they cried when their children died. And we saw when, you know, that they had feelings and they had, you know, vices and all of those things, just like normal people in our society. So anyway, that part of the story crosses from Vikings to Valhalla. And it's part of that DNA that I was talking about earlier.
It would be remiss of me speaking to you if I didn't acknowledge that your first screenplay was actually one of the finest Christmas movies of all time. I am, of course, talking about Die Hard. And for me, that film contains one of Hollywood's great villains in the form of Alan Rickman's Hans Gruber. So my very tenuous link question is, who in your mind is the Hans Gruber of the Viking world?
Oh, if Hans is good, that we've got two or three that I think are great. You know, I think villains, I think what made, you know, Alan Rickman's performance so great is that you could see somebody that you worked with in his character. You could see your boss in his character. You could see, you know, there were so many human elements that he brought to that, that makes that a real good piece. And so what I look at when I'm working on these characters, it's really important to sort of define a character as villainous or the villain. You know, my villainous characters, for example, Yal Kora, who appears, you know, in the first season, is a Christian zealot. He feels driven to, you know, to eradicate, you know, the pagans. And because he is such a zealot, because you can almost identify with his approach, he becomes even more terrifying to watch because he's identifiable. You know, he's not somebody that's just has dropped down from outer space and he has some sort of ideology that you can't touch or you don't really understand, but man, he kills people. And that's what, I mean, everybody killed people by this. So it's like, you got to have some reason that once you understand where he's coming from, it sort of sets off alarm bells. Once you understand what makes a villain tick, then you're part of the story. So I also think that, you know, and this is not a villain in the truest sense, but he has sort of an anti-hero aspect that's wonderful to watch, is Johannes Johannesson's Olaf, Harald's half-brother. Another zealot, but somebody who is a little bit more sophisticated, say, than Yal Kora, who has he's working on a different plateau, knows more. These are more worldly Vikings. You know, he's lived and worked in for Athelred. He has been out of Scandinavia. He has a broader image of what the world is, and that makes him a more terrifying and scary character to watch.
As I was thinking about his questions, certainly Olaf was coming to my mind. But moving on. So, you know, we're not going to spoil the show for our listeners, but suffice it, it's going to take us onwards to meet some more historical characters who we may be familiar with. Olaf, we've talked about. We'll see Edmund Ironside, we're going to see King Canute, we're going to see Emma of Normandy. And actually, we should talk about Emma of Normandy a little bit more, because you mentioned about Viking women having all these rights, but it's some real juxtaposition with Emma. She has all this power, but she's also quite threatened and it could be taken away.
Emma's a great character to talk about because, you know, she was fascinating to me. She comes over as a teenage girl from Normandy, where she had very, very few rights, to England as a bride of King Athelred, who was much older, and within the course of 10 years becomes the second richest woman in Europe. And she did that. She negotiated her dowry. She was able to sort of take over the tax situations of certain key cities in southern England, which were bringing in lots of revenue. And as you said, if the Vikings came over and England lost, she had a lot to lose. I mean, she could be sent back to Normandy. She could lose all her rights and her properties and, you know, her money. And so I found that a very interesting character. We know historically she didn't. And I don't want to spoil this for, you know, the audience, but, you know, I found that Emma becomes a fascinating character, and she, you know, she becomes very close to Canute. And what we've learned over the years is that it set up a, this is one of those gray areas that we were talking about earlier, which is fun to write in. We do know that Earl Godwin, okay, who, you know, whose father loses their title and loses lands, loses everything. He goes from having nothing to finding a way into Athelred's court, to then finding a way into Canute's court, to then marrying into the royal Danish family, to finding a way to move up the food chain, and has a son, you know, Harold Godwinson, who, as we know, well, you know, look, I'm an American and I still know that Harold Godwinson goes up against, you know, William the Conqueror. So it's fascinating. But at the exact same time, Kevin, you've got Emma and Emma's offspring, her two sons from, you know, her marriage with Athelred, Alfred and Edward. And she's got Hartha Canute. This sets up the next 30 years of English history. That's just fascinating. They're great characters to play in, you know, to play with in this time period.
Well, you speak of it setting up the next 30 years of history. I know you've wrapped on season 2. So where are we going next with these characters?
Well, you're just going to have to tune in for that. I can't even tease you with that. But I do think we've touched on some of the things that we're really hoping to see. You know, we would love to tell the full Leif Erikson story. And for me, it's not just a matter of, hey, let's send him to the new world. It's like, what made Leif tick? How did this one particular person, just not bravery, but how did he have the wherewithal to fight those great Atlantic currents that he could find his way there? So I think what you'll find in future seasons is the journey that he goes through in terms of learning and getting more tools in his toolbox, let's say, to become a better navigator, a better explorer, a better adventurer. I think that we'll follow Harold's story, which is fascinating. You know, this someday king of Norway. Well, he didn't just boom, pop into being the king of Norway. So what happened in his journey? Why does he sort of step off the stage for the next, you know, 10 years or 15 years? There's so many other parts of this that are fun to explore. So there's a lot of Viking lore to be mined out there for future seasons.
Do you have it mapped out all the way to 1066 in your mind?
I do. I definitely do. I wouldn't have started if I didn't have a pretty good idea where these characters go. And that helps me because, you know, as we're going through season by season, it's fun to tell the season story, but you're also building a more complex story as well. So you can kind of keep your eye on the overall arc, which is a lot of fun.
And there's a nice thread running through it as well, because there's William the Conqueror. And I'm going to get a number of greats wrong here, but he's the bloodline of Rollo, who we established right at the beginning of Vikings season one.
There's so many nice, you know, pieces of this story that kind of fall back on this stuff. So is Emma. You know, the fact that Emma is not that far removed. I mean, you know, of course, your audience knows this, but lots of people, you know, that forget. And in fact, a lot of the Saxons had forgotten that the Normans were Normans because of the Northmen. It's worth reminding them that Emma comes from that bloodline. You know, she comes from Viking blood. And if by the time we take our story full circle, you know, we as you said, you know, William is part of the Rollo thread.
I'm really looking forward to seeing how you play these stories out on screen. Jip Stewart, thank you very much.
Kevin, thank you.
That was Jip Stewart, who's showrunner for Vikings Valhalla, which is released on Netflix today. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.